Narses slapped his hand down on the table. The sharp sound seemed to fill the confines of the tent.
Belisarius has never trusted mercenaries, hissed Narses.
The eunuch's eyes were fixed on Sangha like a serpent's on its prey.
He never has. He is well known for it in the Roman army, which, as you know, is traditionally an army which uses mercenaries all the time. But Belisarius never uses them except when he has no choice. And then he only uses mercenaries as auxiliaries, Hun-light cavalry for the most part.
Narses jabbed at the map.
So why would he bring 2,000 Goth heavy cavalry with him in a campaign like this one? There's nothing in this kind of campaign which would keep a mercenary's interest, no loot, no plunder. Nothing but weeks and weeks of arduous marches and countermarches for nothing beyond a stipend.
The eunuch laughed sarcastically.
Belisarius never would have brought Goth mercenaries along with him for the good and simple reason, if no other, that he would have known they'd desert within 2 months. Which brings me,
he held up a third finger,
point three. Why haven't those mercenaries deserted?
Another sarcastic, sneering laugh.
Goths are about as stupid as the horses they ride, but even horses aren't that stupid.
Narses planted both hands on the table and pushed himself against the back of his chair. For just an instant in that posture, the small old eunuch seemed a more regal figure than the Malwa dynast and the Rajput king who faced him.
So, let's put it all together. We have one of history's most cunning generals, who always subordinates tactics to strategy, engaged in a campaign which, for all its tactical acumen, makes no sense at all strategically. In the course of this campaign, he drags along a bunch of mercenaries he has no use for, and which have no business being there on their own account. What does that all add up to?
Silence. Narses scowled.
What it adds up to, Lord and King, is Belisarius. He's up to something. Something we aren't seeing.
What? Demanded Demotera. Narses shrugged.
I don't know, Lord. At the moment, I only have questions. But I urge you...
For just an instant, the eunuch's sarcastic, sneering voice was filled with nothing beyond earnest and respectful pleading.
To take my questions seriously. We will find ourselves in the end like so many of Belisarius's opponents, lying in the dirt, bleeding to death from a blow we never saw coming.
The silence which now filled the tent was not the silence of a breath held in momentary suspense. It was a long, long silence, a thoughtful silence. Demotera finally broke it.
I think we should talk to him, he announced. Arrange a parley.
His two companions stared at him. Both men were frowning. Narses was frowning from puzzlement.
What do you hope to accomplish? He'll hardly tell you what he's planning.
Demotera chuckled.
I didn't imagine he would.
The Mawa lord shrugged. The truth? I would simply like to meet the man after all this time. I think it would be fascinating. Demotera shifted his eyes to Rana Sangha. The Rajput king was still frowning. Not from puzzlement, but...
I am bound to your service by honor, Lord Demotera, rasped Sangha. That same honor...
Demotera raised a hand, forestalling the Rajput.
Please, Rana Sangha, I'm not a fool. Practical, yes, but practical in all things.
He chuckled.
I would hardly plan a treacherous ambush in violation of all codes of honor using Rajputs as my assassins. Any Rajputs, much less you.
Demotera straightened.
We will find a meeting place where ambush is impossible. A farmhouse in open terrain, perhaps, which Belisarius's scouts can search for hidden troops.
He nodded at Rana Sangha.
And you, King of Rajputana, will serve as my only bodyguard at the parley itself. That should be enough, I think, to protect me against foul play, and will be enough, I'm certain, to assure Belisarius that he has nothing to fear, not once he has your word of honor, whatever he thinks of my own.
The frown faded somewhat from Sangha's brow, but the quick glance which the Rajput king gave Narses still carried a lurking suspicion.
Demotera chuckled again. Have no fear, Rana Sangha. Narses won't be within miles of the place.
Not likely,
snorted the eunuch. A week later, Demoter's dispatch rider returned with Belisarius' response. The Roman general wrote it out himself, the Rajput said as he handed over the sealed sheet. The man seemed a bit puzzled, or perhaps a bit in awe. He didn't even hesitate, Lord Demoter. He wrote the reply as soon as he finished reading your message. I watched him do it. Demoter broke the seal and began reading. He was surprised, but not much, to see that Belisarius' message was written in perfect Hindi. When he finished, Demoter laughed.
What's so amusing? Asked Narses.
Did he agree? Asked Ranasanga. Demoter waved the letter. Yes, he agreed. He says we can pick the location and the time. As long as Ranasanga is there, he says, he has no concerns about treachery. The Rajput's face was stiff as a board. Demoter smiled, knowing how deeply Sanga was hiding his surge of pride. He transferred the smile to Narses. As for the amusement, Belisarius did add a stipulation, Narses. He insists that you must be at the parley also. The eunuch's face almost disappeared in a mass of wrinkles. Demoter's smile became an outright grin. The Roman traitor, in that moment, was not even trying to hide his own emotions. That great frown exuded suspicion, the way a glacier exudes chilliness.
Why me? Demanded Narses.
Demoter shrugged. I have no idea. You can add that to your list of unanswered questions. Chapter 20. Adulis. Summer, 532 AD. Seated on his throne in what had been the viceroy's audience hall at Sana, Aeon stared down at the crowd. Other than the dozen or so Sarwen standing guard against the walls and his immediate advisors, Antonina, Garmat, and Osanas, the people who packed the large chamber were all Arabs. The Arabs were gathered in clusters. Each cluster consisted of several middle-aged or elderly men, a middle-aged woman serving as a chaperone, and... Christ in heaven, muttered Aeon. There's a horde of them. Did every single Arab in Mecca bring his daughter? Garmat, standing at Aeon's left hand, whispered, Don't exaggerate, King. That's not a horde of young women, merely a large mob. As to your question, what did you expect? There are many tribes in the Hejaz, and each is comprised of several clans. They couldn't agree on a single choice, so every one of those clans sent its favorite daughter. Aeon's jaw tightened. This is no time for humor, old man. How am I supposed to choose one without offending the others? Garmat hesitated. From Aeon's other side, Usanas whispered,
Have Antonina make the choice. She is from Rome. The Empire is very respected, but also very distant. The Arabs will accept her decision as being impartial.
Standing next to Usanas, Antonina's eyes widened with startlement. Before she had time to register any protest, however, Garmat weighed in with his concurrence.
That's an excellent idea. And because she's a woman, she can spend time alone with the girls before making her choice. That gives better odds of making a good selection than for you to just guess looking at a sea of veils.
Aeon looked up at Antonina. Whatever protest she might have made died under the silent appeal in those young brown eyes. An appeal, she realized, which was as much personal as political. So soon after the loss of his two beloved concubines, Aeon was in no mental state to select a wife. She nodded.
If you wish, King of Kings, but I would like to have several days to make the decision. As Garmat said, I can spend the time getting acquainted with the girls.
Take as much time as you need, said Aeon. The king rose from his throne. The faint murmurs in the room died away. As all of you know, he said, speaking in a voice loud enough to be heard throughout the chamber, Aksum has formed an alliance with the Roman Empire against the Malwa. Aeon nodded imperiously toward Antonina. This woman, Antonina, is the wife of the great General Belisarius. She is also an accomplished leader in her own right and is the head of the Roman Empire's delegation. The room was silent. The absence of any whispers indicated the fact that everyone in the room was already quite familiar with Antonina's position. Aeon had suspected as much, but wanted to give emphasis to her importance. I wish to have her select my wife from among your daughters, he announced. There can be no suspicion of any favoritism if the choice is made by Rome's envoy. She will spend a few days in the harem in order to meet the girls before making her decision. Now the room was filled with whispers. Antonina, listening carefully to the emotional undertone of the hubbub, decided that Aeon's announcement was meeting with general favor. Since the Negusa Nagast was clearly prepared to let the crowd's quiet little discussion continue for a bit, Antonina took the opportunity to inspect her surroundings. She'd been rushed into the audience chamber the moment she arrived in Sana. The Viceroy's palace, judging from the evidence, suffered more damage from Aeon's recapture of Sana than the city itself. The heavy stone architecture was still intact. Aeon had used no gunpowder in his assault, simply the spears of the Sarawit, but most of the walls were scorched. The palace walls had been adorned with tapestries, which were now nothing but ashes. Fortunately, the flames had been extinguished before they could do more than slightly char the heavy beams supporting the roof. The rebel Abraha had made his last stand here. It hadn't been much of a stand from the reports Antonina received. Once his Arab auxiliaries had been drawn away from Sana by Antonina's bait, Abraha's two rebel regiments had been forced to face the loyal Ethiopian Sarawit unaided. Even sheltered behind Sana's walls, they had had no great stomach for the task. When word came from fleeing Bedouin that the Romans had shattered the Arab army at the oasis, most of Abraha's troops had mutinied. Only 200 men from his own Metin regiment had remained loyal to him. The rest, and the entire Falha Sawe, had negotiated surrender terms with Aeon. The Negusa Nagast, filled with youthful fury, had not been inclined to grant anything beyond their lives. But Garmat's advice prevailed. The Falha Sawe had been reaccepted as a unit with no repercussions. Even the men from Abraha's regiment who surrendered had gone unpunished, except that new officers had been appointed. The old ones were cashiered in disgrace. Abraha and his remaining 200 rebels had fought it up in the viceroy's palace. The fighting had been ferocious for about an hour, as spears flashed in rooms and corridors. But Abraha's 200 had been overwhelmed by the loyal Sarwen pouring through the palace's many entrances. There had been no quarter given. Not even Garmat had recommended mercy after the body of his friend Sumyafa Ashwa had been found. The former viceroy had been tortured by the Malwa agents who had advised Abraha in his rebellion. Whatever information the Malwa had extracted from the man had not come easily. Sumyafa had died under the knife. The Malwa agents had been captured along with Abraha himself in the very audience chamber where Antonina was now standing. They hadn't been tortured exactly. Ethiopians were not given to lingering forms of death-dealing. Still, the traditional Aksumite way of punishing treason was savage enough. The traitors had been disemboweled and then strangled with their own guts. The latter was simply a gruesome flourish, since intestines are too soft to serve as a proper garrote. Antonina wrinkled her nose. The stench had faded, but it was still powerful. Most of the stone floor, even after hours of scrubbing, was stained with brown marks. Flies were buzzing about everywhere. They seemed to cover every inch of floor where someone was not standing. Antonina stared at the crowd of Arab tribesfolk. All of them were standing on those brown stains, men, women, and young girls alike, with not a trace of squeamishness. Oblivious to the smell, so far as Antonina could determine, occasionally, casually, they swatted away flies buzzing around their faces, but they ignored the insects crawling on the floor. Those people were merchants, not Bedouin. Meccans, mostly, although some were from Yathrib and Jidda, but they were still Arabs. Arabia was the land of the desert, and its people over the centuries had been formed by its harsh regimen. Those folk were much given to poetry and can spend hours in town squares and Bedouin camps engaged in cheerful banter and argument, and they could often be the most generous and hospitable people in the world. But they were not squeamish, not in the least. Ethiopia had repaid rebellion in the traditional coin. The Arab merchants standing before the King of Kings were simply congratulating themselves for having had the good sense to avoid the business. Aeon, apparently, decided that the Arabs had had enough time to think. If anyone has an objection, speak now, he commanded. The room fell silent. Aeon waited for at least a minute. There was no voice of protest. Antonina, watching for the little body twitches which might indicate uneasiness, could see none.
Good idea, Osanas, she murmured.
I am a genius, agreed the former Dawaz. It is well known in educated circles.
Garmat snorted.
Not, of course, among decrepit former bandits.
He began to add something else, but fell silent. Aeon was speaking again. Send your girls to the harem. Servants will show you the way. Antonina will join them shortly. A moment later, the crowd was filing out of the room. The eyes of several dozen veiled young women were now peeking at Antonina. All of those eyes were curious. Some were shy, some bold, some seemed friendly, some uncertain, a few perhaps even hostile. Those last eyes, she suspected, belonged to particularly comely girls, vain creatures who were filled with dark suspicion that an unveiled Roman woman, herself a beauty, would not be swayed by their good looks.
You've got that right, my fine fillies, she thought sardonically. Forget all that nonsense. I'm looking for a young man's wife. That's a different business altogether.
Antonina's task was simplified from the very beginning by her unspoken decision to seek a wife only among the clans of the Quraysh. All the tribes in the Hejaz had sent girls, but that was mainly a matter of pride. The Quraysh, sensibly, had neither objected nor made any demand for precedence. Still, the fact remained that the Quraysh dominated Western Arabia. To pick a wife from any other tribe would offend them deeply. And, on the other hand, none of the other tribes would take it amiss if Antonina chose a Quraysh girl. They were expecting her to, in truth. They simply wanted their own precious daughters to be given formal consideration, which Antonina did. She was careful to spend as much time with the girls from the other tribes as she did with those from the various clans of the Quraysh. That was not simply a matter of show, either. Concubinage was respected practice among Arabs. She intended to select several concubines for the Negusinagast from among the non-Quraysh girls. She hadn't discussed the matter with Aeon prior to entering the harem. Antonina knew the young king was not even looking forward to a wife, much less a gaggle of concubines. But he would yield to political necessity when the time came. Her name was Rukaya, and she was from the Beni Hashim clan of the Quraysh. Antonina dismissed her at first. The girl was much too pretty, downright stunning, in fact, and what was worse, very slender. Aeon was the sole survivor of the Aksumite dynasty, and Antonina wanted to take no chances with the royal line. Her friend, the Empress Theodora, was also a slender woman. Theodora had almost died in childbirth because of her narrow hips. The baby had died, and Theodora had never had another. Antonina wanted a girl with big hips, intelligent also, and with a good temperament. But she wanted a girl who could produce royal heirs without a hitch. Lots of them. But as the hours went by on the first day, in conversations with the various prospects, she found her eyes being drawn toward Rukaya. That wasn't because the Beni Hashim girl was trying to draw her attention, rather the contrary. If anything, Rukaya seemed almost to be avoiding her. There was no way to do so, of course. Not in the harem, which, other than its sleeping chambers, consisted of a single large room. The roof was open, and the center of the room was occupied by a shallow pool. The girls, almost 50 of them, were seated on benches. The majority were packing the benches which fronted the pool, where they would be most visible. But there were perhaps 24 seated on benches ranged against the far walls. At first, Antonina had thought those were the shy ones. But as she became introduced to all of them, she realized that most of the girls on the rear benches were from the non-Quraysh tribes. They knew perfectly well they wouldn't be chosen, and they had seen no reason to gasp for breath in the crush at the pool. All except Rukaya, who, though Quraysh, had clearly not chosen that self-effacing position because of any shyness. Antonina's attention was drawn to her, in fact, because she began noticing how often other girls, as the day went on, would scurry over and exchange words with Rukaya. Antonina couldn't hear those exchanges, but it didn't take her long to understand what was happening. In the first few hours, anxious girls went to Rukaya to settle their nerves. A few words spoken by a calm and friendly face seemed to do the trick. The girls would resume their seats at the pool a bit more relaxed. As the day wore on, Antonina noticed several other girls surreptitiously scurrying over to Rakaia's bench. These, she thought, were downcast because they were not very pretty and were looking for reassurance. The most beautiful girl in the room seemed to give it to them, with words for the most part. But Antonina also noticed the little hugs and the hair stroking, and the time Rakaia held a softly weeping 15-year-old girl in her arms for several minutes. The girl, with her lumpy face and figure, obviously felt she was too unattractive to be a king's wife, which, in truth, she was. Antonina wasn't looking for beauty, first and foremost, but whoever she selected would have to be pretty enough to arouse the king's interest. Aksum needed a stable dynasty. That meant heirs, which a homely queen might not provide. But although Antonina was impressed by Rakaia, she continued to rule her out. For a while, as she listened to one or another girl chatter at her, Antonina mulled over the possibility of selecting Rakaia for one of Aeon's concubines. But she decided against that as well. The daughter of the Bene Hashim was just too beautiful, too attractive in all respects, for that matter. After hours in the harem, observing with her keen eyes and mind, Antonina couldn't fail to notice Rukaya's ease of manner and excellent temperament, all of which, of course, argued against her. She's too skinny for a queen and too dazzling for anything else. Antonina didn't want to risk a situation where the King of Kings produced no legitimate heirs because he was besotted with a concubine. She went to bed the first night with that conclusion firmly drawn. By the end of the second day, the firm conclusion was getting ragged around the edges. The second day was a day for culling. In the course of it, Antonina, as gently as possible, made clear to most of the girls she talked to that they were no longer under consideration. Many of them took the news cheerfully enough, especially those who were not of the Quraysh, but there were others, of course, who were upset. At least half of those, Antonina couldn't help but notice, immediately made a beeline for Rukaya's bench. By mid-afternoon, the daughter of the Bene Hashim was surrounded by a cluster of other girls. It was by far the most cheerful group of girls in the harem. Whatever tears had tracked down those young cheeks were dried, and the girls were laughing at one of Rukaya's soft-spoken jests. The girl seemed to have quite a wit on top of everything else. Antonina had still not exchanged a word with her. She had ruled Rukaia out from the very start, and Rukaia herself had made no attempt to get Antonina's attention. But the Roman woman knew full well what was happening at that bench. There are people in this world who have a knack for it. People who draw others around them like a lodestone draws iron filings. The kind of people whom others, when they stumble and fall, automatically look to for help and guidance. The kind of people, in short, that you like to see sitting on a throne, and rarely do. Antonina shook her head. Too skinny. By the morning of the third day, Antonina had narrowed her selection to three girls. She decided to spend the entire day in private conversations with those final prospects. Rakaia was not among them. Yet when the time came for Antonina to make her announcement to the assembled girls in the harem, her tongue seemed to have a will of its own. After she finished naming the three finalists, the rebellious organ kept talking. "And Rakaia," her tongue blurted out. Across the room, Rakaia's head jerked up. The girl was staring at Antonina wide-eyed. That was due to surprise and something else. Rakaia, strangely, seemed distressed by the announcement. That's odd, thought Antonina. Then, firmly, to her tongue. And she's still too skinny. Antonina interviewed Rakaia last of all. It was already late in the afternoon by the time the Bene Hashim girl entered the small sleeping chamber in the harem which Antonina was using for her private meetings. As Rakaia took a seat on a bench across from her, Antonina admired the grace in the girl's movements. There was something almost sinuous in the way Rakaia walked and slid herself onto a couch. Even the way the girl sat, with her hands modestly folded in her lap, had a feline poise to it. And her clear brown eyes watching Antonina had little in them of a 16-year-old girl's uncertainty and awkwardness. Antonina returned Rakaia's stare in silence for a good minute or so. She was studying the girl carefully, but could read nothing in her expression. That beautiful young face might as well have been a mask. Antonina could detect none of the quick-witted liveliness which she had noticed for 2 days, nor the startled apprehension which had shone in Rukaya's eyes the moment she heard herself named as one of the 4 finalists. Let's clear that mystery up first, she decided. You seemed startled when I named you, Antonina stated. Why is that? The girl's answer came with no apparent hesitation. I was surprised. You had seemed to pay no attention to me the first 2 days, and I wasn't expecting to be selected. I'm too skinny. 2 men, their parents, actually, have already rejected me as a wife. They're worried I will not be able to bear children. The statement was matter of fact, relaxed, almost philosophical. That was its own surprise. Most Arab girls rejected by a suitor's parents would have been heartsick. The problem wasn't romantic. Marriage among upper-class Arabs was arranged by their families. Often enough, the man and woman involved didn't even know each other prior to their wedding. But marriage was the destiny and the highest position to which an Arab girl could aspire. To be rejected almost invariably produced feelings of unworthiness and shame. Yet Rukaya seemed to feel none of that. Why? Antonina was alarmed. An obvious explanation for Rukaya's attitude was that the girl was so egotistical, so enamored of her own beauty and grace, that she was simply incapable of accepting rejection. She might be the kind of person who, faced with disappointment, always places the blame on others. In the long history of the Roman Empire, Antonina reminded herself there had been more than one empress with that mentality. Most of them had been disastrous, especially the ones whose noble birth reinforced their egotism. Antonina's friend Theodora, in truth, had the same innate temperament. But Theodora's hard life had taught the woman to discipline her own pride. A girl like Rukaya, born into Arabia's elite, would have nothing to teach her to restrain arrogance. You don't seem upset by the fact, Antonina said. The statement had almost the air of an accusation. For the first time since she entered the chamber, life came back to Rukaya's face. The girl chuckled. Her face exuded a cheerful acceptance of the world's whimsies. The expression, combined with a little laugh, was utterly charming. My family's used to it. All the women for generations have been skinny. My mother's thinner than I am, and she was rejected 4 times before my father's family decided to take a chance on her. Rukaya gave Antonina a level gaze. I am her oldest daughter. She has had 3 more and 2 sons. One of my sisters and one of my brothers died very young, but not at childbirth. My grandmother had 9 children. None died in childbirth, and 6 survived into adulthood. Her mother, my great-grandmother, had 12 children. She died before I was born, but everyone says she had the hips of a snake. Rukaya shrugged. It just doesn't seem to matter to us. My mother tells me that it will be very painful the first time, but not so bad after that. And she's not worried that I will die. Well, so much for that problem, thought Antonina wryly. But I'm still puzzled. You didn't simply seem surprised when you heard me call out your name. You also seemed upset. Again, Antonina's statement had the air of an accusation. The mask was back in place. Rukaya opened her lips as if to speak. It was obvious to Antonina that the girl was about to utter some sort of denial. But after a moment, Rukaya lowered her head and murmured, I was not upset exactly. It would be a great honor to become the wife of the Negusinagast. My family would be very proud. But she paused, then raised her head. I have enjoyed my life. I'm very happy in my father's house. My father is a cheerful man. Very kind and very intelligent. Rukaya hesitated, groping for words. I have always known, of course, that someday I would be married and have to leave for another man's house, and there is a part of me that looks forward to that day. But not... She sighed unhappily. Not so soon. Her next words came out in a rush. The girl's face was full of life now, and her hands gestured with animation. I don't know what I would do in another man's house. I'm so afraid of being bored, especially if my husband was a severe man. Most husbands are very strict with their wives,
Since I was 10 years old, my father has let me help him with his work. He is one of Mecca's richest merchants, and he has many caravans. I keep track of most of his accounts, and I write almost all his letters, and—
Antonina's jaw dropped. She didn't think there were more than 2 dozen women in all of Arabia, and they were invariably middle-aged widows.
You can read? She demanded.
Rukaya's own jaw clamped shut. For an instant, her young face reminded Antonina of a mule. A beautiful mule, true, but just as stubborn and willful. The expression was fleeting, however. Rukaya lowered her head. Her quick-moving hands once again were demurely clasped in her lap.
My father taught me, she said softly. He insists that all women in his family must know how to read. He says that's because they might be widows someday and have to manage their husband's affairs.
Again, the words started coming in a rush.
But I think he just says that to placate my mother. She doesn't like to read. Neither do my sisters. They say it's too hard. But I love to read, and so does my father. We've had so many wonderful evenings talking about the things we've read in books. My father owns many books. He collects them. My mother complains because it's so expensive, but that's the one subject on which my father lays down the law in our house. Most of our books are Greek, of course, but we even have—
She stopped talking then, interrupted by Antonina's laughter. The laughter went on for quite a while. By the time Antonina finally stopped, wiping tears from her eyes, Rukaya's expression of shock had faded into simple curiosity.
What's so funny? She asked.
Antonina shook her head. The Nagusa Nagast of Ethiopia is one of the world's champion bibliophiles. His father, King Caleb, amassed the largest library south of Alexandria in his palace at Aksum. In all honesty, I don't think Caleb himself actually read any of those books, but by the time Prince Aeon was 15, he had read all of them. I remember when he came to Rome how many hours he spent with my friend Irene Makrombolitisa. She is the world's greatest bibliophile. Antonina fell silent, staring at the girl across from her. Again, tears welled up in her eyes as she remembered a friend she thought she would never see again. Oh, God, child, how much you remind me of Irene. Memory made the decision. Memory of another woman, intelligent, quick-witted, active, whose own life had been frustrated so many times by the world's expectations.
Fuck it. We have souls, too. You will be happy, Rukaya, predicted Antonina, and you will never, I promise you, be bored.
Again she wiped away tears, and again laughed.
Not as that man's wife.
Oh, no. You'll be keeping track of the King of Kings accounts, Rukaya, and writing his letters. He's building an empire, and he's at war with the greatest power in the world. Soon enough, I think, you'll find yourself longing for a bit of tedium. Finally, the face across from her was nothing but that of a young girl. A virgin, barely 16 years of age. Shy, anxious, uncertain, apprehensive, eager, curious, and of course, more than a little avid.
Is he? Will he?
Rukaya fumbled and fumbled.
Yes, he will like you. Yes, he will be kind. And yes, he will give you great pleasure.
Antonina rose and walked over. She took Rukaya's face in her hands and fixed the girl's eyes with her own.
Trust me, child. I know King Aeon very well. Put aside all doubts and fears. You will enjoy being a woman.
Rukaya was beaming happily now. Just like a bride.
Chapter 21.
Garmat did not beam happily when he first saw Rukaya.
She's too skinny, he complained.
Standing in his place of honor on the lower steps of the palace entrance, he turned his head and hissed in her ear.
What were you thinking, Antonina?
Antonina's humor was a bit frayed because of the heat. Standing under the bare sun of southern Arabia, wearing the heavy robes of imperial formality, was not enjoyable. So, for an instant, the decorum of a Roman official was replaced by the response of a girl raised on the rough streets of Alexandria.
Piss on you, old fart, she hissed back.
Then, remembering her duty, Antonina relented.
I checked the family history, Garmat. All the women are slender, but none of them have had problems with it. Rukaya's mother... There followed a little history lesson. Not so little, rather. Antonina had expected the issue to arise, so she had supplemented Rukaya's own account with a more thorough investigation. Happily, the girl had not been sugarcoating the truth. For as many generations as clan memory went, which, typical of Arab tribesmen, was a long way back, only two women in that line had died in childbirth. That was better than average for the day. Her history lesson concluded, with all the solemnity of a Roman official, the Alexandria street urchin returned.
So piss on you from a dizzy height, old fart.
Well said, came Usanas's whisper.
The former Dawaz, he still had no official title, was standing right behind them on a higher step. Antonina cocked her head a quarter turn.
You're not worried? She whispered over her shoulder.
Sourly.
I expected every man within 50 miles to be crabbing at me about it.
Usanas's gleaming grin made a brief appearance.
Such nonsense. It comes from too much exposure to civilization and its decadent ways. My own folk, proper barbarians, never fret over the matter. Women drop babies in the fields, just like elands and lions.
Garmat, still tight-faced, began to mutter again. He was giving his own lecture now on natural history, explaining to a bird-brained Roman woman and an ignorant Bantu savage the difference between passing a large human skull through a narrow pelvic passage and the effortless ease with which mindless animals... He fell silent, stiffening with formal rigidity. The King of Kings was finally entering the square before the palace where his bride and her party were waiting. It was quite an entrance. Antonina, even after her years of exposure to Roman imperial pomp, was impressed. Aksumites, as a rule, were not given to formality, but when occasion demanded, they threw themselves into it with the wild abandonment of a people shaped by Africa's splendor. Aeon was preceded by dancers, leaping and capering to the rhythm of great drums. The dancers were garbed in leopard skins and cloaks of ostrich feathers. The drummers were clothed less flamboyantly. They wore shamas, the multi-layered togas which were the usual costume worn by Ethiopians in the highlands, but these shamas were for ceremonial occasions. The linen was richly dyed and adorned with ivory and tortoise-shell studs. Behind the dancers and drummers came Aeon's ceremonial guard. This body consisted of the officers of his regiment and was much larger than normal. Aeon had been adopted by 3 regiments, not the customary one, and all of them were present. Masi, Aphilus, and Saizana, as commanders of the Dekuan, Lazin, and Hatafan Sarawit, led the procession. Here, Aksum's more typical practicality made its reappearance. True, the soldiers were wearing ostrich plume headdresses, which were far larger and more elaborate than anything they would have worn in battle. But the weapons and light armor were the same practical and utilitarian implements with which Ethiopian army went to the field of slaughter. The soldiers were there, not so much to protect their king from assassins, as to remind the huge crowd packing the square of a simple truth. Aksum rules by the spear when all is said and done. Do not forget it. Studying the crowd, however, Antonina could detect no signs of resentment in the sea of mostly Arab faces. The people of the desert, for all their love of poetry, were not given to flights of fancy when it came to politics. That rulers will rule was a given. That being so, best to have a strong rule and a firm one. That makes possible, a fair rule as well. Antonina decided she was reading the crowd properly. All the faces she could see were filled with no expressions beyond satisfaction and the pleasure of people enjoying a great spectacle. The measures which Aeon had taken, the concessions which he had given the Hejaz, even more than his leniency toward the Bedouin rebels, had gone a long way to mollify southern Arabia to Ethiopian rule. The marriage about to take place, she thought, would finish the job. Arabs were as famous for their trading ability as they were for their poetry and their incessant political bickering. They knew a good bargain when they saw one. Aeon entered the square now, and splendiferous royal pomp soared to the heavens.
Good God, whispered Antonina. Is that thing solid gold?
Garmat smiled. His usual good humor was back.
Of course not, Antonina, he whispered in return.
The chariot made of solid gold would collapse of its own weight.
The wheels and axle, anyway.
Garmat bestowed a look of admiration on the vehicle lumbering into the square.
That there's plenty of gold on it, believe me. Enough gold plate to make it seem solid even on the undercarriage.
He made a little pointing gesture with his beard.
Those elephants aren't there just for show. The beasts have their work cut out for them hauling the thing.
Not to mention their own costumes, murmured Antonina. The four elephants drawing the chariot were cloaked in a pachyderm version of ceremonial shamas, not battle armor. But Antonina didn't even want to guess at the weight of ivory and tortoiseshell decorations. Aeon was riding alone in the open-backed two-wheeled chariot. The chariot itself was patterned after the ancient war chariots of Egypt, which were designed for two men, one to control the horses while the other served as an archer. But Aeon didn't require assistance. He had no reins to hold. The elephants were controlled by four mahouts. Those men, Antonina was relieved to see, were wearing nothing beyond their usual practical gear. The four elephants drawing Aeon's chariot were war elephants with the temperament to match. God help the crowd if the mahouts lost control of them. Aeon's own costume, to Antonina's eye, was a bit odd at first, until she realized she was seeing the usual Aksumite combination of splendor and practicality. On the one hand, his tunic was made of simple, undyed linen. A Roman emperor, any Roman nobleman for that matter, above the level of an equestrian, would have worn silk. But the utilitarian cloth was positively festooned with pearls and beads of red coral, and the threads which held the garment together were inlaid with gold. His tiara, unlike the grandiose crowns of Roman or Persian emperors, was nothing more than a silver band studded with carnelian. The simplicity of the design, Antonina suspected, was to emphasize the importance of the four-streamered headdress which the tiara held in place. That was called a faculin by Ethiopians, and it was the traditional symbol of Aksum's King of Kings. She thought there was a subtle message in that headgear. Aeon had already announced the day before that the capital of Aksum was being moved to Adulis. The Arab notables gathered in the palace had reacted to the announcement with undisguised satisfaction. The decision to move the capital, those shrewd men knew, was the surest sign that their new ruler intended to weld them into his empire. The center of Aksum from now on would be the Red Sea rather than the highlands, a center which was shared by Arabia along with Africa. Today, gently, Aeon was reminding them of something else. He still had the highlands, after all, and the breed of disciplined spearmen forged in those mountains. Their symbol still rode on the top of the Negusa Nagast's head. His staff of office carried the same message. The shaft of the great spear was sheathed in gold, as was the Christian cross surmounting it. Sheathed in gold and decorated with pearls. But the blade itself, the great savage leaf of destruction, was plain steel and razor sharp. The slow-moving chariot finally reached the center of the square. The mahouts brought the elephants to a halt, and Aeon dismounted. In a few quick strides, he took his place next to his bride, and the wedding ceremony began. The first part of the ceremony, and by far the longest, consisted of Rukaya's conversion to Christianity. That went on for 2 hours. Long before it was over, Antonina, sweltering in her robes, was cursing every priest who ever lived. In fairness, she admitted the fault lay not principally with the priests. True, they were their usual long-winded selves, the more so when they basked in the warmth of such a gigantic crowd's attention. But most of the problem came from the sheer number of conversions. Rukaya wasn't converting alone. Everyone had known, of course, that the new queen of Ethiopia would have to become a Christian, if she was not one already, as many Arabs were. Her own father, the day after Rukaya's selection was publicly declared, had made his own announcement. He and all his family would convert also. That had been a week ago. By the day of the wedding, well over half of the Beni Hashim had made the same decision, and a goodly portion of the other clans of the Quraysh as well. There were hundreds of people in the square, well over 1,000 by Antonina's guess, who were undergoing the rite alongside their new queen. For all her sweltering discomfort, Antonina didn't begrudge them that ceremony. True, she suspected that most of the converts were driven by less than spiritual motives, canny merchants seeing an angle, but not all of them. And not even, she thought, any of them. Not completely, at least. Arabia was a land where religion seethed under the surface. Most Arabs of the time were still pagans, despite the great success which Jewish and Christian missionaries had found there. But even Arabia's pagans, she knew, had a sense that there was a supreme god ruling the many deities of their pantheons. They called that god Allah. As the conversion ceremony wound its way onward, Antonina's mind began to drift. She recalled a conversation she had had with Belisarius before he left for Persia. Her husband had told her of a religion which would rise out of Arabia in what had been the future of humanity. Islam, it would be called, submission to the one god named Allah. The religion would be brought by a new prophet not more than a century in the future, a man named Muhammad. For a moment, she started erect, snapped out of a reverie by a specific memory of that conversation. Her eyes darted to Rukaya standing in the center of the square. Muhammad will also be from the Beni Hashim clan of the Quraysh, and if I remember right, will have a daughter named Rukaya. She realized that her choice of Rukaya, in ways she hadn't even considered, had probably already changed history. The Beni Hashim of Muhammad's future had not been Christians except for a few. After today, they would be. How would that fact affect the future? She slipped back into memory. Will it still happen now? She had asked Belisarius. After all that's changed? Her husband shrugged. Who's to know? The biggest reason Islam swept the Levant and Egypt was because the Monophysites converted almost at once. Voluntarily, most of them. Muhammad's stark monotheism, I think, appealed to their own brand of Christianity. Monophysitism is about as close as you can get to Islam within the boundaries of the Trinity. Melisarius scowled. And after centuries of persecution by Orthodox Christians, I think the Monophysites had had enough. They saw the Arabs as liberators, not conquerors. Antonina spoke. Anthony's trying... I know he is, agreed Belisarius. And I hope the new Patriarch of Constantinople will be able to rein in that persecution. Again, he shrugged. But who's to know? Standing in the square, sweating in her robes, Antonina could still remember the strange look which had come to her husband's face. It's odd, really, he'd said, how I feel about it. We've already, just in what we've done these past few years, changed history irrevocably. He patted his chest where aid lay in his little pouch. The visions aid shows me are just that now. I can still learn an enormous amount from them, of course, but they're really no more than illusions. They'll never happen, not the way he shows me, anyway. His face for a moment had been suffused with a great sadness. I don't think there will ever be a Muhammad, not the same way, at least. He might still arise, of course, and be a prophet, but if Anthony succeeds, I think Muhammad will more likely be a force regenerating Christianity than the founder of a new religion. That was how he saw himself, actually, in the beginning, until Orthodox Christians and Jews rejected him, and he found an audience among pagans and Monophysites. Antonina had been puzzled. Why does that make you sad? I would think you'd prefer it. You're a Christian yourself. Belisarius's smile, when it came, had been very crooked. Am I? She remembered herself gasping, and just as clearly she could remember the warm smile in her husband's face. Be at ease, love. Christianity suits me fine. I've no intention of abandoning it. It's just... The look of strangeness, of strange wonder, was back on his face. I've seen so much, Antonina, he whispered. Aid has taken me millions of years into the future, the stars beyond the galaxy. How could the simple certainties of the Thracian countryside withstand such visions? She'd been mute. Belisarius reached out and caressed her face. I am certain of only one thing, he said. I can't follow half of Anthony's theology, but I know he's right. God made the Trinity so unfathomable because he does not want men to understand him. It's enough that we look for him. His hand, leaving her cheek, swept the universe.
Which we will, love, which we will.
We are fighting this war at bottom so that people can make that search, wherever the road leads them. His gentle smile returned.
That's good enough. For a simple Thracian boy raised to be a soldier, that's more than good enough.
Finally, it was ending. Antonina almost sagged from relief. She felt like a melting blob of butter. She watched as Aeon turned to Rikaia and removed the veil. Then she fought down a grin. The king of Ethiopia, for the first time, saw his new wife's face. He seemed like an ox struck between the eyes by a mallet. A little gasp, not so little, actually, went up from the crowd. Some of that was caused by shock at seeing a young woman unveiled in public. The Arabs had known it was coming, of course. Aeon had made very clear that he was only willing to concede so much to Arab traditions. Ethiopian women did not wear veils, not even young virgins, and the King of Kings had stated in no uncertain terms that his new wife would follow Aksumite custom in that regard. Still, the matrons in the square were shocked. Shocked, shocked. They could hardly wait to scurry home and start talking about the scandal of it all. But most of the gasps came from Rukaya's sheer beauty. The crowd had been expecting a pretty girl, true, but not this. Within seconds, the gasps gave way to murmurs. Looks of shock and surprise were replaced by... I will be damned, thought Antonina. I didn't even think of that.
You are a genius yourself, Antonina, whispered Ursanus. That is what a queen should look like. Then will you look at the greedy bastards? Every one of those coin-counting merchants just realized there's no way the King of Kings is going to ignore his new Quraysh bride.
Garmat's opinion was otherwise.
She's too gorgeous, he complained. We'll never be able to pry Aeon out of his bed, with a hiss.
What were you thinking, Antonina?
Antonina ignored the old fart. She simply basked a bit in the admiring glances sent her way by the crowd. And she positively wallowed in the penumbra of another's admiration. Even at the distance, she couldn't misread Aeon's face. That young face had been shadowed ever since he found the mangled bodies of his concubines in the stones of the Ta'aka Mariam. Now, at last, she could see the shadow start to lift. Like her husband before her, Antonina had come to love Aeon as if he were her own son. She realized now that it was over that she'd been guided throughout by a mother's instinct, not the calculations of a diplomat. She trusted that instinct far more than she trusted the machinations of politics. Garmat still didn't understand, but Ursanus did. The tall hunter leaned over and whispered,
A genius. I say it again.
Antonina shrugged modestly.
It's a good match.
The girl's father, I think, will make an excellent advisor in his own right. And Rukaya herself is very intelligent. She'll...
Not that nonsense, snorted Ursanus.
He sneered at Garmat.
Ursanus' sneer was as magnificent as his grin.
Politics is a silly business. Games for boys too old to grow up.
The famous grin made its appearance.
Wise folk like you and me understand the truth. As long as the boy is happy, he will do well. Everything else is meaningless.
That evening, at the great feast in the palace, Aeon sidled up to her. He began to fumble with words of thanks and appreciation. Antonina smiled.
She's very beautiful, isn't she?
Aeon nodded happily.
She's smart, too. Did you know that she can actually read? And she's funny. Even before I lifted the veil, I thought I would be enamored. She told a little joke while the priests were droning on and on. I almost died trying not to laugh.
He was silent for a few seconds, admiring his wife. Rukaya was the center of attention for the crowd and had been since the feast started. At the moment, she was surrounded by many of the young girls who had spent the days in the harem with her. Antonina, watching the ease with which Rukaya handled that little mob of admirers, who had not so long ago been her rivals, congratulated herself once again.
She'll make a great queen.
The final reward came. Aeon took her hand and gave it a little squeeze.
Thank you, he whispered. You have been like a mother for me.
Toward the end of the feast, Rukaya sought her out. The young queen drew Antonina aside into a corner of the great chamber. She clutched Antonina's hands in her own.
I'm so nervous, she whispered.
Aeon and I will be leaving very soon for his private chamber. I'm so nervous, so scared.
Antonina smiled reassuringly, almost placidly. The expression was hard to maintain. She was waging a ferocious battle, not against giggles, but uproarious laughter. What a lot of crap. Do you think you can fool me, girl? You're not scared. You just can't wait to get laid, that's all. But a mother's instinct came to the rescue again.
Relax, Rukaya.
Forget what you might have heard. Most men, believe it or not, don't mount their wives like a bull mounting a heifer.
They actually talk first.
Some of them, anyway. Aeon will. Rukaya's eyes were boring into her own like a disciple staring at a prophet.
Hell with it. Antonina did laugh.
Relax, I say. She pried loose one of her hands and stroked the girl's cheek. Humor faded away under the intensity of Rukaya's gaze. Half dreading, half hopeful, half eager, half curious, half...
That's way too many halves.
This girl's got too many emotions going on at once.
Trust me, Rukaya, she said softly. When the time comes, Aeon will be very gentle. But it may not come as soon as you think. Maybe not at all tonight.
Rukaya's mouth gaped wide. Antonina's hand went from the girl's cheek to her lustrous, long, black hair. Still stroking, she said,
Remember, girl, he recently lost concubines that he loved very much. It will be hard for him, too, when you're alone. He will be reminded of them and be saddened, and he will be nervous himself. He's not a virgin, of course.
She fought down a giggle,
to put it mildly. But he's still a young man, not much older than you. In the beginning, I think he will just want to talk.
Slowly, Rukaya's mouth closed. The girl thought on Antonina's words for a time as the Roman woman kept stroking her hair. The words and the caresses began to calm her.
I know how to do that, Rukaya announced. I'm good at talking.
The next morning at the breakfast feast, Garmat began grumbling again.
What were you thinking, Antonina?
The old advisor was sitting right next to her, in a position of honor near the head of the great table. Usanas was seated on her other side. The two positions at the very head of the table, of course, were reserved for the King of Kings and his new queen. Judging from the fanfare of the drums, they were about to make their entrance.
What were you thinking? He repeated.
I just discovered the girl can read on top of everything else.
Wonderful. Two bookworms. They probably spent the whole night talking philosophy.
He shook his head sadly.
The dynasty is doomed. There will be no heirs.
Aeon and Rukaya swept into the dining hall and took their seats. Usanas took one glance at their faces and pronounced the obvious.
You are a doddering old fool, Garmat. And Antonina is still a genius.
Yes, I am, she thought happily. A true and certain genius.
Chapter 22. Persia, summer, 532 AD.
It looks like he's coming alone, said Demodera, squinting at the tiny figure in the distance.
The Mamwa lord cocked his head toward the tall Rajput standing next to him.
Am I right? Your eyes are better than mine.
Sangha nodded.
Yes, he's quite alone.
The Rajput king watched the horseman guiding his mount toward them. The parley had been set on the most open patch of ground which Sangha's trackers had been able to find in this stretch of the Zagros. But the bleak, arid terrain was still strewn with rocks and small gullies.
That is his way, Lord Demodera.
Sangha's dark eyes were filled with warm admiration.
His way of telling us that he trusts our honor.
Temodera gave Sangha a quick, shrewd glance. For a moment, he felt a twinge of envy. Temodera was Malwa, practical. He didn't share Sangha's code of honor, nor even the prosaic Roman version of it possessed by Belisarius. But Temodera understood that code. He understood it very well. And he found himself, as he had often before, regretting that he felt no such certainty in the face of life's chaos. Temodera was certain of nothing. He was a skeptic by nature, and had been since his earliest memories as a boy. He wasn't even certain of the new gods which ruled his fate. He didn't doubt their existence. Like Sangha himself, the Rajput king was the only man who had ever done so beyond Malwa's dynasty, Temodera had spent time alone with Link. Temodera, like Sangha, had been transported into visions of humanity's future. He had seen the new gods and the destiny they brought with them. No, Temodera didn't doubt those gods. He didn't even doubt their perfection. He simply doubted their certainty. Temodera didn't believe in fate and destiny and the sure footsteps of time. Belisarius was close enough now for Temodera to make him out clearly. That Temodera believed in. That and the reality of the Rajput standing next to him in the shade of the pavilion. He believed in horsemen riding across stony ground under the light of a mid-morning sun. He believed in the sun and the rocks and the cool breeze. He believed in the food resting on platters at the center of the low table in the pavilion. He believed in the wine which was in the beaker next to the food, and he believed in the beaker itself. None of those things were perfect. Even the sun, on occasion, had spots, and they were very far from being certain beyond the next few hours. But they were real. Temodera was Malwa, practical. Yet he had discovered, as so many practical men before him, that being practical was a lot harder than it looked. So for a moment he envied Sangha's certainties. But only for a moment. Humor came to his rescue. Temodera had a good sense of humor. Practical men needed it. "Well, we can't have that," he proclaimed. "A commander should have a bodyguard." Temodera turned his head and whispered something to Narses. The eunuch nodded and passed the message to the young Rajput who was serving as their attendant in the pavilion. A moment later, the youth was on his horse and cantering toward the Rajput camp, a short distance away. And so it was, by the time Belisarius drew up his horse before the small pavilion in which the parley would be held, that he discovered that he would have a bodyguard after all. Valentinian helped him down. The cataphract wasn't wearing any armor beyond a light Rajput helmet, but he was carrying a sword slung from a baldric, and, of course, knives and daggers. Belisarius could see three of them thrust into a wide sash. He didn't doubt there were